I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. In January, three new state senators and 12 new state representatives were sworn in at the State House. What's it like being the so-called new kid on the block? Is it tough to get attention on your priorities? Joining us today are our three newest members of the Cape and Islands legislative delegation, State Senator Julian Sear, who represents the Cape and Islands District. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
State Representative Dylan Fernandez, who also represents the Cape and Islands. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Great to be here.
And State Representative Will Crocker, representing the 2nd Barnstable District, which is parts of Barnstable and Yarmouth. Good morning to you.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
All right. So before we get to issues, I want to start with a little bit of behind the scenes. So you're sworn in, and then what? Are there mentors that help you find your way? I mean, you get placed in what's called the bullpen. Tell us about the bullpen.
Yeah. So we, Will and I, were placed in this freshman bullpen, which is really this kind of cramped committee hearing room. And there are 12 freshmen. But they also bring in staff into this room. So there are 24 of us in this, what I would consider a pretty small room. And yep. So it gets loud, noisy, busy. And Will, why don't you talk about it a little
bit
too?
Well, exactly. It's us and our staff. So plus the two people that the speaker's office puts in there to help us out and you know, just to be there to ask questions about. So it can get loud in there when people come in to talk to you. People come in to lobby you. You know, friends come in. Oh, I was here. I wanted to stop by and say hello. And, you know, it can get a little noisy. And you do try and find another place to really conduct business.
So I'll also add, I think it's the only office in the State House without a triage office in front of it. So the activists and lobbyists just stream
walk
in
right in.
So sometimes, I mean, just last week we had these education activists come in, and there were probably 60 people in our office on top of the staff advocating for funding for education, which is terrific. But when you can't hear yourself think, a lot of times Will and I will head over to the library or something to get a breather to work on some substance.
So there's 160 state representatives. How soon will it be before you get your own office?
Well, go ahead, Will.
I was going to say, as the only member of the minority party, there's not a lot of movement going on as far as the Republicans are concerned. I am the only new Republican, so I'll probably get my office. I keep saying this to people, like, maybe this week or next week. And I've said that for about a month now, but I'm really hoping that I'll hear that there's some movement next week because it's easy to move me. The other members, the new freshman Democrats, it's probably going to be a little bit longer for you guys.
Yeah, so the first step in that is getting committee assignments. Mm-hmm. And then with the committee assignments, the chairs will shuffle to their new offices. And then we're kind of at the bottom of the totem pole as new people in terms of new offices.
There's only 40 state senators.
I know.
So what was you get sworn in, then what?
Each of the senators actually has their own office. And you occupy the office that your predecessor had. So I went into Dan Wolf's office. We'll do some shuffling on the Senate side as well. You know, the process really in the Senate started actually long before swearing in. Right after the election and through the election, heard from the Senate president, sat down and connected with leadership. We had a day-long retreat in the Senate in December to identify priorities that we want to tackle. There was also a several-day-long new legislator training workshop in Amherst that all of us attended. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you pretty quickly work to build relationships with folks and sort of ask for help. I worked on the Hill, so I kind of know where the bathroom is and those sort of things. But certainly relying on folks who've been there, you're asked to do a lot. So we started January 4th. Bill filing deadline was January 20th. So you've got to turn around pretty quickly to file those bills. And then soon after that is a deadline to co-sponsor legislation. And you receive so much correspondence, hundreds of correspondence.
That's a lot of homework, isn't it? Yeah.
And you know, on one end, you want to be responsive to the requests of constituents. And on the other end, you want to do your due diligence. You know, I think in the Senate President Rosenberg has a real – his mantra is shared leadership, shared responsibility. And so how the Senate does our business, it's not just sort of the sort of old-fashioned top-down sort of legislative from leadership approach. What I've been really amazed by is how much of a voice that I have, that my colleagues Adam Hines and Walter Timmelty and Joe Boncori, that were the new folks in the Senate, that really in caucus and that in – in Senate deliberations, we're already having a voice, which I'm kind of taken still taken aback by, and I kind of got to pinch myself to be like, wait, I'm in the Senate President's office, having lunch with everyone. Yeah, they're listening to me, and so that's a really tremendous humbling experience.
Dylan, you mentioned that the freshman class, so to speak, coming in here are pretty much on the young side. Tell what's that like?
So there are 12 new members in the class, 8 are under the age of 35, and I include Will in this category. So make that 9. This is probably the youngest class in a generation, maybe 2 generations. I think it's really exciting because we're bringing a lot of new energy to this and also a lot of innovative ideas, because we're living a lot of the crises that are going on when it comes to affordable housing. I mean, our generation is living that, being unable to afford a place to live in our hometown. And I'll also add, just kind of as a funny anecdote, so I'm 27. The person I sit next to is actually 5 years younger than me. Yeah. So when these lobbyists stream into the bullpen, a lot of times they confuse us with AIDS.
With AIDS.
And they give us, and they give us their packet of information and say, will you pass this to the legislator? And of course, like, you know, I want to get my work done. So
sure.
I have to avoid a conversation. I'm like, yes, I'll pass this right along to him. Thank you so much.
I don't have that problem.
Well, and what's really exciting too, in the Senate, we've had a real emergence of millennials over the last several cycles. So now 5 of the 40 state senators are under 40, which is pretty that's a sizable chunk of the body. But what's really exciting, especially about these reps, these are folks who, we're not establishment people. In some cases, they challenge incumbents, and that they really through. A lot of shoe level leather and, knocking doors and working really hard, they were able to convince voters to send them to Beacon Hill. And I think that's really powerful, especially in this moment where we have all this turbulence nationally. And I think there's a renewed interest in public service for a whole host of reasons. It's really exciting for me to be as the youngest state senator, I'm 31, I'm old compared to some of these folks, and that's so exciting.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you a question. Being a Republican, and it's obviously a lot of Democrats up at their state house. Did you feel welcome? Do you feel like there's we talk about Congress in Washington and how divisive it is. What is it like on a state level? Are you feeling welcomed there?
Oh, absolutely. We had an opportunity. I think the first time we met was December when the Speaker had a little get together in Boston, and I think a number of us met the whole members of the class for the first time. I hadn't met any of the other members who had successfully been elected. So the Speaker had Minority Leader Brad Jones and the other Democrats, and we all got together and we had a chance to be able to kind of find out a little bit about each other and where our priorities are and where where our feelings are on the issues, and that was a good thing. And that was immediately. That was in early December, and that was a very good thing. And then, as Julian had mentioned, we had the Legislative Academy for 3 days. We were all together, reps and the senators together in Amherst, and it's legislative boot camp 101: how to file bills, how they go, what committees, that kind of thing. So, we have been included as a member of the minority party. I have been included. Spoken with the Speaker on a number of occasions. He actually knows who I am when I walk down to the office or I see him in the hallways. Mr. Speaker, good morning. And he refers to me. So it's not a situation of a them versus us when it comes to communicating.
That's I'm really struck by how sort of postpartisan or not partisan the environment is, especially within the legislature on Beacon Hill. Even in the Senate as well, we have 34 Democrats and 6 Republicans. But really that I've worked most closely with Vinnie DiMacedo and other colleagues, because a lot of the issues that we're working on are not necessarily partisan issues. These are issues of regional concern, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Shout out to Sarah Peake. She doesn't like to be referred to as the dean of the Cape Cod Legislative Delegation, she's reached out to me and says, if there's anything I can help you with, please, contact the office.
I'd also add that, as a Cape delegation, I'm one of 2 Democratic representatives.
Right.
But you know what? We are all about, for the Cape and Islands, you know, we're this hinterland kind of caucus here. And it's not about partisanship. It's about what we can do together to further and advance issues in our local communities. And that's not a partisan thing. So I am more than happy to work very closely with my counterpart in Falmouth and Representative Vieira and my state senator, Vinny DiMacedo, and reps across the Cape, like Will, on issues that are important to our local Cape and Islands.
Well said.
Yeah. Before we get to issues, committee assignments. Everybody happy with their committee assignments?
Absolutely. I'm very happy. The Republican leader asked for our top five Christmas list. I got three out of the five. I'm on Children's, Families, and Persons with Disabilities, Mental Health, Substance Abuse and Recovery with Dylan. Those are both joint committees, and also Travel, Tourism, and Culture. And that's huge here on the Cape. Very happy with my committee assignments.
Dylan?
I got every single assignment I asked for.
Wow.
It was three for three. I was shocked, yeah. Pleasantly surprised. And, you know, those are environment, natural resources, and agriculture. Huge, huge committee for our district. Substance misuse and mental health, as Will said. You know, my district is home to some of the highest opioid death rates in the state. And also, I'm with Julian on municipalities and regional government. And that is really important because a lot of the big housing bills that come up in the state house go through that committee. And so, of the bills that I filed this session, over half of them are going to a committee that I sit on, which is really terrific.
Mm. Right. So, when I looked strategically, like, you know, what do you request? I looked at the issues that really emerged. And what emerged in our campaign time and again and time and again was housing affordability. So look to see, you know, where can I have the most impact? I'm the chair of Community Development and Small Business. This was my first choice committee. And this is the committee that oversees a number of affordable housing initiatives, the CPA oversees, but I was also the committee where the zoning bill and the zoning reform will be coming out of that committee. So I'll have a very significant hand in being able to guide that committee. I'm the vice chair of Elder Affairs and the vice chair of Arts, Tourism, and Culture. So these are two critically important committees for our region with, you know, our older population and an aging population, and especially with tourism, the state's done a really poor job dedicating resources to fund tourism, and so that's something I like to look at. And then I sit on public health, which is something I have I come out of public health. I also sit on municipalities. I sit on the housing committee. I've already been talking with my colleague Joe Boncori about having a sort of statewide listening session with our two committees talking about housing affordability. And then what's the one? And I'm on one other
public
too.
Public health.
Public health.
All right, we're talking with State Senator Julian Cyr, State Representative Dylan Fernandez, and Will Crocker. We'll get to the issues after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with the three newest members of the Cape and Islands Legislative Delegation, State Senator Julian Cyr, State Representative Dylan Fernandez, and State Representative Will Crocker. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you have a question for one of them. 866-999-4626, or all of them. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Let's talk about health care. We've heard some details about the repeal and replace plan for the Affordable Care Act, what that might look like. Thoughts on how that might impact your constituents here?
Significantly. So the proposal that comes out, essentially it eliminates the federal individual mandate for people to have health insurance. It reduces the amount of money and changes the amount of money that people are getting to help pay for health insurance and turns it just sort of into flat tax credits based on your age. And it makes an employer mandate retroactive to 2016. What essentially this does is, in a lot of ways, it sort of takes Obamacare and sort of pulls out all these pieces that make Obamacare function and work. And so what essentially I think you'll see happen is a real sort of collapse in the current system. We've seen a lot of success in Obamacare in states that have implemented the full Medicaid requirements of that. So specific to home, first of all, there's also in this proposal a move that moves Medicaid to a block grant program. So right now, we essentially receive resources from the federal government based on how many people we have on Medicaid. Moving that to a block grant puts the Commonwealth likely in a situation to be short about $2 billion, $2 billion in a $40 billion budget. You know, for our communities, certainly some concerns specifically with the Martha's Vineyard Hospital, which is one of three hospitals in the state that have a special designation under the ACA as critical access hospitals. And a lot of concern as well that where we've been seeing success in health and healthcare is a real coordination of care that the Affordable Care Act has undertaken and really making sure that people are getting into care early and staying in that care. And that's going to be really put into question with this pretty reckless proposal.
Anybody else want to
add? I'll just add a little bit. The ACA has been an incredibly good deal for Massachusetts. 85% of our Medicaid costs are reimbursed by the federal government. In 2020, it was going to go up to 90%. That is a huge chunk of money to get to what Julian's talking about. And losing that is really going to affect us in a really hard way. We have the lowest uninsured rate in the nation at 3%. And the reason we have that is because of these terrific federal funds that we've received over the years to make sure that we can put those who don't have insurance on the rolls to get the health care that they need.
No, I look at it this way. I kind of look at it as it's the Affordable Care Act amended. I mean, if you look at we get a quick look at it, it's amend this, amend that, change this, strike this. So it's still the ACA, but it's the ACA amended. Some people may say it's ACA light. One of the things that I was very happy is that the ban on pre-existing conditions is still in place. So people who have pre-existing conditions still will be able to get that. And the other thing is what's not in it and what I hope will be in phase two or phase three, which is the interstate sale of insurance. I want to see that in there so that people can be able to buy and sell insurance across state lines. There's no reason why it can't be that way.
I think this is really going to raise an interesting conversation in that, you know, let's remember that actually the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, actually comes out of what was a Republican proposal from the late 80s and early 90s, was implemented you know, by a Democratic legislature and a Republican governor here in Massachusetts first. And really what may end up happening with this in a state like Massachusetts, you know, if I can find a silver lining here, and it's hard to find a silver lining with losing $2 billion and really make, you know, having our most vulnerable and the old and the vulnerable in our society sort of pay more for health insurance to benefit, you know, corporations, to benefit, you know, tax cuts for the wealthy. The one silver lining here maybe is that we're so screwing it up that it's going to require us to seriously look at other options. Single payer is an option. That this is something that I certainly support. I filed a bill that Senator Wolf had filed previously that essentially requires the state to study costs related to a single payer system and to the current kind of sick care system we have now. So, you know, we might be so in a ditch with this that, you know, it may prompt new policy and new conversation.
Rod is giving us a call from Brewster. Good morning. Rod, are you there?
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm calling from Brewster. I represent Safe Communities Coalition, which is people from towns from the mid to the outer Cape who are working to establish safe community policies in our town. And we prefer that term to sanctuary town because we feel it's more accurate, though the aims are much the same, to build safety and trust in our communities, including among those who may be anxious about their undocumented status. Establishing that local law enforcement will refrain from investigating the documentation of persons they might encounter through minor infractions and emergency calls and other such things. And my question is for Senator Scheer. I wondered if he might speak about his decision to co-sponsor the Massachusetts Safe Communities Act, how he sees it likely to progress, and how it would affect local towns here on the Cape.
Rod, thank you.
Thank you, Rod. I really appreciate the question. I'm proud to have sponsored the co-sponsored the Safe Communities Act. I believe, Dylan, you're on this, too.
I co-sponsored as well, yes.
You know, and actually, this is This act, actually, it's filed in the House by a colleague of ours, Juana Matias, who actually is the daughter of undocumented immigrants, represents Lawrence Rouleau. I got it right. And so, you know, what I think is, you know, so here's why I'm supporting this. I think, one, we've really seen a failure of the federal government over many years to enforce immigration laws. We've seen a failure of our federal government to look at the demand that our economy has placed that has attracted, you know, over 11 million immigrants here.
It's 13.
13 million, thank you. And a real disconnect with our policy. And I think now we have an administration that clearly has shown a disregard for due process, a disregard for the Constitution, is erratic, is, you know, and it's not looking about going about law enforcement in a responsible way that protects people's rights. And I think what the Commonwealth needs to do, all of our states are, all of our towns are home ruled, right? So the fact that the federal government now may be taking retaliation against, you know, a town, the town of Brewster or the city of Boston, that's something that as a state we need to make sure that we are sort of uniformly protecting our communities. In practice, if you actually sit down and talk to chiefs of police and the sheriff, and I've done this and I think we all have, in practice, all of our communities here on the Cape and Islands are complying with the Obama administration guidance, essentially that prioritizes violent criminals and doesn't coordinate with ICE otherwise. I think that continues to make sense. There's a question about, you know, sort of what do we call ourselves and how do we make sure that the people who are living in our communities who are really rightfully scared. I mean, this is an issue that's home to us. I mean, I know of. I mean, we were in Martha's Vineyard for a forum, and we had over 350 people in a forum, including dozens, maybe over 100 folks in the Brazilian community, really concerned. I know of actually several moms on the WIC program in Nantucket who've actually stopped using WIC because they don't want their name on a list, and they have you know, that their children are American citizens. So we need to really remember that we have children who are in our communities who are fearful every day that they're going to come home and their parents aren't here.
Well, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I look at it this way. Two things. Number one, I think what we really need to do and what we really need to look at is enforcing the laws that we have in place right now. We enforce those laws, I think we will have a much better handle on what we're on the situation. First thing. Second thing is, I think somebody mentioned it, home rule. I think this needs to be handled at the lowest levels possible. I think the most important thing is to make sure that the local communities are safe and that the local people have the responsibilities when it comes to maybe boards of selectmen or police chiefs. Those are the people. When it comes to responsibility in government, the lowest level, the local level is the best level. But again, that and just enforcing the laws, the immigration laws we have on the books right now, I think is a safe way to be able to act.
Mm-hmm. Can I add? You know, I come at this, and I'm a proud co-sponsor of this legislation. You know, we're all immigrants. The only people who aren't immigrants in this country are the Native Americans and people who came over as slaves, right? African Americans, and you know. We have our country is better. Our country is great because of the contributions from our immigrant populations. And right now they're scared. And if you look at the data, the rhetoric out there by this administration couldn't be more wrong. You know, there's a lot of comprehensive data out there that shows that our immigrant populations actually produce less crime than people who are here, people who are residents and citizens here. So this is a bill that's common sense. It helps protect our local immigrant populations. It makes them feel comfortable coming forward to the police. There's a couple of public safety aspects to this. You know, one is that undocumented immigrants are often scared to report crimes.
They become victims.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Domestic violence.
They're a witness to a crime. They don't report it. There's big public safety implications here. And, you know, just yesterday I sat down with police chiefs on the Vineyard, and they're totally on board with this. They know that they're not, you know, reporting to ICE because they're pulling over people for a parking violation or something like that. I agree that, you know, if someone commits a felony, sure, that can be reported to ICE. But if no one should be deported from our country for having an unpaid parking ticket.
Yeah. And Rod had asked about sort of the prospects for this bill. So we do have a number of co-sponsors. I think if your coalition and others are looking to push this, I think the folks to weigh in with are our House leadership. I think in the Senate we have a number of sponsors on this, and I think that there's I would probably direct that attention to House leadership at that moment.
I mean, we did a program on this yesterday immigration. So the immigration attorney that we had on brought up an interesting point for local police departments who are not trained, and there's a lot of various legal statuses that you can have that may not be quite obvious when you pull somebody over for a traffic violation. So not being trained, the police departments open themselves up to false arrest, which in turn can turn to lawsuits, which can cost town's money. So that's something else, I guess, just to throw in the mix and think about. John is giving us a call from Orleans. Good morning, John.
Good morning. As the legislators know, Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant is terribly dangerous. It's a potential Fukushima or Chernobyl. It's my understanding that there's a plan to call for the NRC to require that Pilgrim be fixed. That is completely the wrong approach. Pilgrim cannot be fixed. And what that plan would do is it would give the public the idea that Pilgrim can be fixed and thus calm them. And what you need to do instead is publicly call for the closure of Pilgrim, stressing its danger, because that will put pressure on the NRC and it will alert the public how dangerous it is. You're following the wrong approach, if I'm right about that that plan to call for the fixing of closure.
Well, let's find out about that, John. I hadn't heard about that.
One of the things that I may be a little bit different from the rest of my Republican colleagues is that I'm very afraid of the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant. The NRC says it's going to stay at a level 4, which is only one level up from being forced to close. I don't want to have a nuclear power plant at level 4 less than 20 miles away from where I live. And when you talk about the evacuation plan, there are two evacuation plans. The first one is you have to head towards it before you can head away from it. Or the second one is start swimming east, which scares me. Obviously, no one can swim east.
They're not alone there, by the way.
The Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant has shown a history of less than stellar performance. And I'm not in favor of it being refueled again, and that apparently is what's going to be is in the process right now. I would like to I know all my other colleagues are very concerned about it. Let's get this started. Let's get the shutdown started as soon as possible.
You know, I building off of what Will said, the only thing we know that this sort of bad actor utility Entergy is motivated by their bottom line, and so. What I think has gotten them towards deciding to close by 2019, if not sooner, has been specific efforts to increase costs to their operation. I filed new legislation this session that basically requires them to essentially adds a cost to maintaining spent fuel in that fuel pool, so that they're moving those into dry cask storage. I've publicly called for this plant to be closed, and I continue to. But I think that, we have an obligation as legislators to both be looking at, one, how do we make sure this plant gets into decommissioning and has a safe decommissioning so that, regardless if the plant is closed tomorrow or in 2019, we have arguably the largest hazardous waste dump in Massachusetts in Plymouth. And I think, two, that, John, I'm not familiar with the specific proposal you're talking about, but any of these strategies have been around how do we get Entergy to take a look and say, operating this plant, operating this plant for the next year and a half is just not beneficial to our bottom line. We're trying to work with ISO New England and the grid to get them to forgive. Essentially, there's a $150 million fine if Pilgrim would go offline before 2019. We're trying to get that forgiven. So we're trying to provide a menu of options for to basically push Entergy to make the right decision to say, hey, you need to close this thing. Unfortunately, there's nothing that I can do or many in our state can do to actually close this. And that's really the frustrating situation. We all met with the NRC. There was public meetings with the NRC. I think that our dissatisfaction with those meetings is clear.
Yeah.
But, we are in – I think there's the – there's the rhetoric and there's a calling for the plant to be closed, which like we're all in for. But then there's also strategically, how do you actually put the pressure on this utility to get them to close sooner?
All right. Let's talk about the vote on the salary increase for legislative leadership and other elected officials. Representative Crocker, you voted against that.
And, I did.
And Julian and
yep.
Dylan voted for it. So tell me your thinking on why you voted the way you voted. Dylan, we'll start with you.
Sure. You know, this is an increase that for the House pay, the House pay adjustments fall within the House budget. So the money isn't coming from anywhere else. This is a system that this is a bill that ends the per diem system, which means that you get paid by day based on how far away you live from the state house. That is something that isn't kept track of, was never kept track of. That is something that we'd seen abused in the past with legislators saying they're at the state house 5 days a week when in fact they were there only one or two. This brings transparency to the system, ends that per diem system and replaces it with a flat fee based on how far away you live, with 50 miles being the threshold. And so it brings more transparency to the process. And also, you know, this is an issue where, you know, the Speaker of the House is making under $100,000 a year, but controls a $40 billion budget. You know, legislators and public officials and those who work in public service salaries are never going to compete with the private sector, but there has to be some incentive there to bring more kind of new innovative people into the public sector, and you do that through a salary. And there's a lot of data out there on this. You know, my background is in economics. There's a lot of economic studies out there that show that the more you pay legislators, the better they perform, the less susceptible they are to outside influence of money. And basically, you know, you pay someone with peanuts, you get monkeys. It's like, is how, you know, some people put it. And we want the best and the brightest. It's never going to compete with the private sector, but I think a boost is fine. For me personally, I don't get any increase. It's just for leadership positions. Some people have asked, hey, you got a $40,000 increase. Well, no, my increase is negligible because of how far away I live. My predecessor, Tim Madden, who lived on Nantucket, had an extremely high per diem. He would probably lose money under this proposal. So there's actually winners and losers in this. It's not just this flat pay raise.
Yeah, and you know, I think both Will and Dylan and all freshman members in the House are not seeing any meaningful increase, you know, off of this. I think this is a classic example on Beacon Hill of sort of like the kicking the can down the road problem that we tend to have. Compensation really had not been meaningfully raised since 1982, which is long before I showed up or Dylan showed up. You know, so basically you have this sort of unwillingness to make increases because, let's be honest, it's a politically tough vote, right? It's something that no matter what the data says, no matter what we know from a policy best practice, you know, this is a tough vote that people don't like to take.
Yeah.
And so, you know, really it's like you kick the can down the road from 1982. You know, of course, these increases look very, you know, look and sound and are large. If you annualize the increases, it's less than 1% a year since 1982 to now. The reason why I supported this is I actually, you know, this is for me about diversity in who can serve in our government. And I think if you look carefully at who has been able to run for office, who has been able to serve as our governor, our last three governors are millionaires. If you look at my predecessor, definitely is someone who has different means than I have. And I think if we want to have a diverse, inclusive government, especially if people who are not the status quo, if people who are not, you know, older, whiter, male identified folks, I think, you know, we need to make sure that that really brilliant, you know, we were talking about Juana Matias before or other colleagues, that really brilliant person who, you know, could go work at a corporate law firm or could run for office, we need to be at least a little competitive there. And so for me, this is about inclusion. I get that the process was done hastily. I think folks are right to be upset about that. You know, and I think there's a fair critique there. But I think for me, I don't want to perpetrate the sort of bad kicking the can down the road fiscal policy that my has done.
I look at it this way. When I ran for a state representative in the 2nd Barnstable District, I was applying for a job. I knew how much that job was going to pay. I decided I would run, and I got elected. The people that voted for me knew what the job paid, And I said, yeah, I'm going to sign on for that. And if you elect me, I will get that. Now, that being said, leadership does get, if you are a committee chair or a vice chair, you do get some more money. We have all now been lumped into this, what you call a business expense now. How am I going to take care of the business expense? Well, I'm working out a formula with my CPA to be able to say, all right, if I'm going up to Boston X number of days in the year, how much will that be with my per diem? So basically what I'm going to say is I'm going to take the money basically when I go up there. If I go up, let's say, for instance, a number, 80 days, then I will take the per diem for 80 days. The rest of the money I'm going to give to charities, and I will disclose which charities I give them to. And the other money, and she doesn't know this yet, so I'm going to – this is if she's listening, she's about to find out. My aide, I haven't talked with her about it yet, but one of the things we're talking about is that I'm going to give my aide I'm going to pay for her transportation. She comes in on the train every day from where she lives, and I feel that I'm going to I want to pay for her transportation costs because it is significant on a daily basis, and I want to help her out if I can.
And I think what Will's doing here is, I think that's admirable, right, that to vote against it and sort of to figure out a strategy that way. I just want to point out, not in the Senate, but in the House, House minority leadership are taking this money. We just found out that they're taking this money. And for some folks, we're talking about $35,000, $40,000 stipends after voting no. So at least, I think that's important. If that's important to call out in the Senate, my Senate colleagues on the Republican side are not taking the money. And I think that's important to discuss.
We're talking with State Senator Julian Sear, State Representatives Will Crocker and Dylan Fernandez. We'll talk more after a quick break. Listening to The Point, we are talking with the three newest members of the Cape and Islands Legislative Delegation, State Senator Julian Sear, State Representative Will Crocker, and State Representative Dylan Fernandez. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Business community very concerned about having enough workers to meet the summer demand. As mentioned, we talked yesterday about changes to the H-2B and the J-1 visa programs. And as you all know, this can really hurt local business. I know this is a federal issue, but with Representative Crocker and Senator Sear sitting on the Joint Committee on Tourism, Arts, and Cultural Development, love to hear your thoughts on this. How do we address this?
I think we were talking about it yesterday at the Commonwealth Conversations. This is not an immigration issue. It's a business issue. It's a small business issue. It's a tourism issue. We need to be able to get these people here who need to be, and it's a trickle-down effect, you can use that term, but it's a trickle-down effect. They, to steal some of your words, Senator.
Please.
These people may work the back of the house. If you're talking about people who work in restaurants or people who work in hotels, they work the back of the house. They're the people that are working in the kitchens or working in the laundromats. They handle the back of the house, and they, because they are there and because they are doing those jobs, create the jobs, sustain the jobs for the front of the house. So it's a symbiotic relationship there. I know a gentleman who owns a restaurant in Orleans, a seasonal restaurant in Orleans, and he has difficulty being able to get his workers in here for the summer season. Again, it shouldn't be an immigration issue. It's a small business issue. It's a tourism issue.
So I've lived this issue personally. I mean, my family owned a restaurant for 28 years. And increasingly relied on H-2B workers because it was just so impossible to find folks to work, especially in the back of the house. And you actually had H-2B workers actually are, in a way, very skilled workers who come year after year, who know how to set up your kitchens and how these sort of seasonal operations work. As we've really tried to extend our season here in the region, and I think in some places that's made a difference. It's working. A longer season means that, in the old days, in the 70s and 80s, relying on college students to come and work, that's just not feasible from a seasonal perspective. And by the way, you're going to spend $6,000 just to pay rent to be here for a summer and make that amount. So the H-2Bs really are actually help with job creation. The Lobster Pot in Provincetown did a fascinating report on the impact. They had struggles with their H-2B visas last year. They opened a month late and closed a month early. Mm-hmm. And that resulted in significant, the over 80 American employees who you know, who rely on the program. So there's a, you know, this is a federal issue. We've been working closely with Congressman Keating's office on this. Last week, I sat down with Secretary Walker, Ron Walker, who's a labor and workforce development secretary, with Sarah Peek, with members of our business community to raise the issue. Yesterday, the Senate, we have a Commonwealth Conversations tour where we go around the state, and essentially it's a listening tour. We were on the Cape yesterday, and 11 of my colleagues and I listened to business owners really around the H-2B issue. You know, but I think that the federal government is currently creating a very uncertain situation for seasonal businesses, and we're just going to have to keep at it. But it's a very challenging situation.
I just want to echo that. You know, I'm the son of small business owners here in town. My district of Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, and Falmouth relies heavily on these workers. And right now in Massachusetts, we have an unemployment rate of 3.1%. Where are we going to get these seasonal workers? We're almost at full employment in our state. And so we're going to have, this is a big concern for local businesses, especially on the islands, who rely heavily on these workers. And so we need to make sure that they're able to come so that we can sustain our tourism industry. And on our tourism industry, you know, one part of our president's really what I view as un-American actions in terms of banning people, in terms of having a Muslim ban, in terms of having this really kind of what I consider xenophobic rhetoric. We've seen a 12 to 14% drop off in tourism to America. And for us locally, this is huge. On the islands, Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, they get $35 million a year from international tourists. For the Cape, it's something like $130 million a year from international tourists. If we see a 12, 14 higher percent drop off on that, that has a huge impact on our local economy.
You know, and Dylan, I think you had it set up right on the head, and that this, you know, un-American rhetoric is toxic for our economy. And, you know, I just think we're going to continue to unfortunately see the implications of just this very irresponsible, you know, rhetoric, a very fascist almost, you know, movement towards demonizing people. It's just not what we're about. It's not what this country's about, and it's not what this region is about.
I want to go back to listening tour for a second, because there's an issue that we used to talk a lot about, and that was the inequality in the Chapter 70 education money. And, you know, every time we have an election cycle, we have this, you know, we're going to get up there and we're going to change that funding formula. And we haven't really heard much in recent years. So have we given up on that? When you had the listening tour, was that an issue that was brought up at all to educate your fellow colleagues on that?
That's certainly been raised, especially for the Cape and for the region that we represent. You know, Will, this is most challenging. I think Dennis Yarmouth loses out the most here on the current Chapter 70 formula. There actually is a subcommittee of the Education Committee that's going to be led by Senator Jalin on the Senate side that's going to be looking at the foundation budget. But, you know, from my perspective, I don't think we're going to be meaningfully able to change the formula without sort of expanding the pie, right? So this is why I'm a big proponent of the Fair Share Amendment, which is in 2018 we're going to be bringing to the voters to have millionaires and billionaires pay their fair share and earmark those resources for education and for infrastructure. You know, I think for our communities, you know, certainly we're going to make the argument on Beacon Hill that we should, you know, that these formulas should be tweaked to benefit our needs. You know, the challenge is that we have a perception challenge because we happen to live in this beautiful place that people visit 8 or 13 weeks out of a year and they think it's just wealthy paradise.
So didn't somebody on the tour ask you if you live in one of the waterfront homes?
Yeah. They did. And it's like,
Nope.
You know, actually, a lot of our members actually have some of them come down here on vacation here. And so trying to show people, and what's great about this listening tour was showing my members sort of, you know, what it's like on the off season here. And I think people don't have an appreciation for that. So we're working on it. But from my perspective on Chapter 70, you know, we were in Brockton last night, and Brockton has major challenges in inequities with Chapter 70. So I think that we've got to expand the pie to meaningfully make some change here and provide more resources for our community.
Anybody else want to chime in on that?
I'd love to chime in. I mean, just to get to Julian's point, I think a huge part of our job is just educating our colleagues about the unique nature of our district. And so for me, you know, I represent Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket. Because they're islands, they have really unique challenges. And, you know, Nantucket has the third highest home costs, third highest home sales, cost for buying a home in the state. Cambridge is number one, right? But Cambridge can get workers from Somerville, Revere. Mm-hmm. No one's coming out of the Atlantic Ocean to support, you know, to work in Nantucket. So these are issues that are unique to the islands. And so a lot of times what they'll do is we'll have home rule petitions to address these unique issues. And so part of our job is lobbying up on Beacon Hill about these unique issues because of the geography that we have here.
I want to thank Senator Scheer for allowing me to tag along with all the other senators. I was the only state rep there, but I appreciate that. And
glad to you joined us.
Got a chance to taste some great Barnstable oysters and compare them with the Wellfleet and Truro oysters, and we can get into that later. But with regard to Chapter 70, yeah, we have problems in the second Barnstable district as well. And I look at it from a bigger point of view. I was at a legislative briefing last week, and someone brought up the idea, and it gave me cause to start thinking that with the Education Reform Act in Massachusetts being, you know, 20 plus years ago at this point, you start looking at, you know, maybe it's time to look at that and look at it from a much larger point of view. Do we need to change things? Is our educational philosophy different than what it was in the mid-1990s? And if it is, then we need to look at that. And, of course, Chapter 70 funding needs to go along with that as well. So I look at it from a larger point of view.
Yeah, Dylan, I'm going to ask you this question. President Trump issued an executive order last week asking the EPA to review the Waters of the United States rule. So there's the potential to remove wetlands from the Clean Water Act. And I'm thinking, could this weaken our state wetland regulations? Are you up? I don't know if you're up on this.
Yeah, so I, you know, for me, environmental issues are the most important issues that we face as a district. For my generation, there's not going to be a bigger impact or a bigger issue than climate change, and certainly for my children's generation as well. And you know, on Monday, we hosted a talk with the Woods Hole Research Center right here in Woods Hole that is ranked as the number one think tank in the world on climate change research. So we have incredible resources here also in HUI and MBL, and we know what these environmental changes are going to do to our local communities. And so we need to be more aggressive now than ever before in terms of addressing environmental issues. And when it comes to kind of fighting for clean air, clean water, we need to get serious about renewables and expanding our renewable energy portfolio. I'm really excited about the offshore wind project that's going out 12 miles south of the Vineyard. This is the first project in Massachusetts, second project in our entire country. And this is an area where this is the windiest place in America. People call it the Saudi Arabia of wind. I think that's probably a little off message, but you get the point. You know, this is an incredible resource. So we need to be really expanding our clean energy portfolio. I'm a co-sponsor of a bill that calls for 100% renewable by 2050 because, you know, the time to act on climate change and environmental issues was yesterday, right? But we didn't. So now we need to take really aggressive actions. And I've been extremely concerned about what's been going on the federal level. And we have a climate change denier as our president. So I think we need to double our efforts here in Massachusetts based on what we've seen the federal government put forward.
All right. Well, we'll be looking forward to seeing what comes from our new legislative members here, State Senator Julian Scheer, State Representative Dylan Fernandez, and State Representative Will Crocker. Thanks for coming in and sharing the first couple of months
Thank
in
you
office.
For having us.
And,
Thank you very much.
I'm sure we'll be chatting again in the near future. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.